May 13th, House Water Committee. One meeting to go. Okay? We are going to start. Welcome to all of you. We're going to start by opening a work session on House Bill 3281. Do I have amendments, Mr. Kess?
Yes, you do.
Are they clean?
They, according to the proponents, they are, but you can
Christina
ask.
And Anita?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Christina McNant with Oregon Water Resources Congress, and the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 3281 are clean and reflect the conceptual discussions that we had before this committee last Thursday.
Thank you, Christina. Is there anyone else that wants to comment on the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 3281? We are in work session, and I would take a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 3281.
Representative Tomei moves the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 3281. Is there discussion? Is there objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Thank you.
Representative Tomei.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3281 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Tomei moves House Bill 3281 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Is there objection? Call the roll.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative Cruz.
Excuse me.
Representative Schaffler.
Aye.
Representative Tomei.
Aye.
Representative Dingfelder.
Excuse.
Representative Krupp.
Excuse.
Chair Jensen.
Aye. House Bill 3281, having received the constitutional majority, has passed and will move to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I would take a motion on the consent calendar.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3281 to the consent calendar.
Representative Dingfelder. Representative Tomei moves House Bill 3281 to the consent calendar. Is there objection? Hearing none, so ordered. The work session on House Bill 3281 is closed, and we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 590A. Do we have any sign-ups on this?
Do you want me to read?
Yes, Mr. Tess.
Senate Bill 590A in gross requires Water Resource Commission to initiate proceedings for cancellation of water rights within 270 days of submission to Commission of evidence of water right forfeiture.
Thank you. And I have Mr. Brad Harper from Water for Life here to testify. Cleary just said they just do that resource. Good morning, Brad.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Brad Harper, Executive Director of Water for Life. I'm here today to ask the committee to support Senate Bill 590. Water for Life requested this bill after a circumstance arose during some contested case proceedings with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, where we discovered that the department didn't have any statutory obligation to process allegations of cancellation in any particular time frame. And it became important in the contested case proceedings we were involved with because U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service was trying to transfer several tens of thousands of acres. Pardon me for just a moment. I should know better.
You're going to have to. There
we go. Thank you. We were involved in those contested case proceedings, and it became clear that a number of the acres amongst these tens of thousands of acres that were proposed for transfer were actually not legally subject to transfer. They in fact, had been forfeited, or we were alleging they had been forfeited due to five or more years of non-use. And our concern was, had the transfer process completed before the allegations of forfeiture were addressed, the cancellation would become a moot point because all the previously forfeited acres would have been essentially recaptured administratively by the transfer process. To their credit, and as I noted in my testimony, the department has not completed the transfer proceedings. They have held off on completing those following our repeated request that we deal with the cancellation first. However, I will note it took quite some time, over a year, to draw that out. And in the future, we think that it would be good public policy to give the department a fairly discrete timeline. We had initially asked for a 45-day timeline. The department, through negotiations, came back with a 270-day timeline. Mm-hmm. Whatever the number ultimately the legislature chooses, we think shorter is better. And we think that it's important to note that we're not asking for them to resolve cancellation proceedings within any given timeline. We just want them to initiate those proceedings, because having done that portion of it, then we would be confident that any subsequent or earlier transfer proceedings that hadn't been completed would be put on hold until the cancellation issues were resolved. Thank you.
Okay. There are questions for Brad?
Mr. Chair, Brad, in regard to, you had requested a 45-day timeline, and the department came back with 270 days?
That's correct. In fact, I think they may have originally came back with something even a little longer than 270. I don't recall exactly. The point I think the department was making, that if they had a 45-day timeline, they were going to have a fiscal impact. I believe they said they would have to dedicate a full-time employee to deal with cancellations. By moving the timeline back, my understanding is the department says it will be less of a fiscal impact. We're still at odds, I think, on that issue, because it's hard for us, given the number of cancellations they process, they're not relatively that many. I understand they're around half a dozen or more every year. They should have the resources within the department to initiate those proceedings, and again, not necessarily have to resolve them immediately, but to at least initiate those proceedings and get that ball rolling.
You're saying 45. I'm sorry, Representative, does that answer your question?
Well, in regard to how that came about, yes.
Are you saying that in your estimation, 45 days is sufficient?
We believe so, Chair Jensen. If the way we've proposed the process would work is that the department would receive all the allegations, the affidavits of non-use, and a request to initiate cancellation proceedings. They would look at it upon their determination that they had a complete, all the materials they needed were complete, and that they had the information to start the investigation. Then that would trigger the beginning of the process. So I know I've had discussions with Adam Sussman at the department about this. His concern, one he raised to me, was that what if, you know, we get incomplete affidavits? What if we don't get that information up front? And my response and my belief, the way the law is written, the bill is written, is that the time wouldn't be triggered. The timeline to initiate proceedings would not trigger until they had a complete application or a complete packet of whatever they need to initiate those proceedings.
Any other questions for Brad? Thank you very much. Appreciate
Thank you.
It. Please. Yes. You're going to bring your legal counsel with
Thank
you?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Just going to leave them sitting in the audience to
twisting in the wind.
Twisting in the wind. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul Clary, Director of the Water Resources Department. We appreciate this opportunity to present testimony on this bill. I've got some written testimony here, and some of it provides background on what cancellation proceedings are, but I think if you'll turn the page to the discussion, you'll find out why we wanted to work with the bill proponents and did successfully on the other side to amend the bill to, one, clarify when the trigger takes place, and two, to provide us a sufficient time frame to initiate the proceedings within existing staff resources, so as Brad indicated, we wouldn't have a fiscal impact that wasn't anticipated in the governor's balanced budget. These are serious proceedings. and when we initiate them, if we've got erroneous information on non-use, we could improperly propose to cancel a valid water right and really trigger a costly and time-intensive process for the owner of that water right. Because once we trigger it, they're the ones that then have to provide information to counter what was alleged in the non-use affidavits. And so what we try to do, obviously, like anything else, is when we get these, we try to work with water users and the affiants to identify opportunities to informally resolve the water right cancellations. As Brad had indicated, in the case of the Malheur transfer, we worked with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service on an agreement that some of the rights that aren't involved in the transfer, they're going to proceed with a voluntary cancellation on, and the rest of them we're dealing with the allegations of non-use prior to processing that transfer. Now, they had originally proposed a 45-day time period. We'd come back with a year. They countered with 180 days. Our concern with 180 days was if we could assure that the allegations of non-use came in the fall, and we had kind of our season, our non-distribution season to work on them, that'd be fine. But if they came in April, when I've got all my field staff working on water distribution and water regulation, I basically would have to pull water masters off of those activities to complete that within that six-month time frame. That's where we then settled on 270 days to give us the 90 days in addition to that. So that's our with those amendments, we no longer were opposed to the bill, and we believe that we can do it within existing resources.
Mr. Clary, as I told you earlier, I'm going to amend the bill to 180 days, and I'd like Brad to come back.
Certainly.
You may stay there and go one-on-one if you want.
I'll get the medical kit out.
Yeah, Mr. Chair. If you would. We're able to do that in this committee because we have qualified people to handle those sorts of emergencies. Explain to the committee, I mean, you said you don't have to be completed. And I'm hearing testimony from the department about completion. I'm hearing testimony from Water for Life about starting the process. What am I missing here?
I might, before Brad answers that, the initiation of the process is what imposes the burden on the individual who's alleged to forfeit the water rights. So that's where all of a sudden we shift expenses and legal defense burdens onto those holders of water right. And so that's why we wanted the time to make sure that prior to us initiating that, we had the opportunity to ensure that there wasn't any erroneous information in it.
Brad Harper again with Water for Life. I think that matches what we're saying. We're saying that they initiate the proceedings. They say, okay, we're formally going to begin a cancellation proceeding, but then the time it takes to complete that proceeding is uncertain and will almost, you know, inevitably vary depending on the case and how clear the forfeiture issues are.
Right. So what happens, as I understand under this bill, is once we determine that the information is complete, and again, all that means is it's got to meet the standards of requirement. If we've got two affidavits, they've got to identify what water right they're talking about. They've got to talk about the location, non-use, period of non-use, and a statement of their knowledge about the subject area and water rights. Once we get that, we then determine it's complete. So that's what triggers the 270 days. And that's the time period we then have to try to resolve it informally, to check that information out, and to do what we can to ensure that we don't trigger a potential forfeiture and a burden on a water right holder based on erroneous or incomplete information.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Representative Forrest.
A question. Mr. Clary, in your written testimony, the bottom of the first page, you indicate
right.
that once or you have notice or evidence that a water right is to be forfeited, that you initiate cancellation proceedings by providing written notice to the legal owner of the water right,
right,
and to the occupant of the lands that the water rights are pertinent.
Right.
How does that written notice, is it certified mail, return receipt, and regular mail?
I'm not sure, Representative Flores. I can find that out for you, though. I'll let you know. We certainly, again, it's serious proceedings, and we do everything we can to go check it. And we actually, in a lot of cases, because we involve our water masters, we actually go out on the ground and make sure that they're aware of this. Knock on doors.
Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Representative.
Paul, I just want to make sure that I understand this. So before you make the or do the notice of cancellation, you have to do a lot of work before
right.
that happens.
Right.
So if I understand you correctly, then especially if this were to happen in the spring, since there's a time limit to provide the notice, then you would have to take someone from other processes to work on providing the information about whether or not this cancellation notice would be appropriate. Am I understanding you correctly?
Chair Jensen, Representative Tomei, right. And that's our concern, that we'd have to pull our field staff off of other activity, because this indeed is an investigation that requires us to go out and look at the parcel and look at surrounding areas and talk with people. So that's our concern about the 180 days. If we could assure that we didn't get them at the beginning of our busy season, we wouldn't have that problem. But we can't assure that. And since we are establishing time frames, we just want to make sure that we could deliver on those time frames.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, other questions? We're going to close the...
thank you.
Public hearing on Senate Bill 590 and open work session on Senate Bill 590. And the chair would like a motion to amend the bill on line 7 to strike 270 and to insert 180.
So made, Mr. Chair.
Representative Krupp moves to amend. What's the word I want?
Conceptually.
To conceptually amend. Thank you. To conceptually amend Senate Bill 590A by striking 270 and inserting 180 days. Is there discussion on that?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to make a comment. I'm
yes.
supportive of this. A good idea. But I'm kind of new at this, but I've seen a lot of this kind of thing down here in this building where we're reducing staff, reducing government expenditures, and at the same time, and in no way am I expressing any disrespect or disagreeing with this, but at the same time, adding workload onto public employee staff. And we're not giving them any more money to do it with or any more resources to do it with. And I'm editorializing here, Mr. Chair, so I appreciate your patience. But somewhere along in this system, it's all going to go to heck in a handbasket unless we're willing as Oregonians to step up and pay for these services. And I'm very concerned about that, but I do not object to the amendment, sir. Thank you for your patience.
Thank you. I think I share some of your concerns on this issue. However, I don't, see this one as being a, and I appreciate
yes,
your statement with it. I think there is always a tendency of the legislature to do this. We hear complaints from cities that we pass the buck to them without increasing their revenue. We hear complaints from counties to the same sort of thing. And I would submit, colleagues, that probably we do the same thing to ourselves. I believe this session we have put timelines on when we are expected to get our work done by in a way that has caused us, at least in this committee, on one occasion some disagreement among members of the committee, feeling aggrieved by trying to get more done in less and less time, and certainly that is a balancing act. I think the number of days here is a compromise issue, and so Representative
Tomei. Mr. Chair, I have problems with this, with the amendment. It seems to me that the people who were concerned with these issues dealt with it in the Senate, and we've heard very little testimony, and it was Senator Messerly's bill, and I guess my feeling is that if we were going to limit the days, shorten the number of days that the commission has to investigate this, that we should have had more work provided for the hearing, and that the Senate probably spent more time on this than we have. And if this was what they agreed to in the Senate, I have some problem with us changing that. So I'm going to be voting no on the amendment.
Thank you, Representative Tomei.
Well, I might as well join the crowd. I actually will support the amendment, Mr. Chair. However, I share some of the concerns that my colleague, Representative Schaffler, raised, in that I've worked really closely with several water masters, and, you know, they are amazing folks, but they can only do so much. And the concern that I have, and my sense is this is going to change watershed by watershed. I mean, it's going to basically, some basins won't have as many cancellations going on, and others might have more. So I think it's going to be, as Paul Cleary said, the agency is going to have to decide and shift some resources to probably assist water masters in certain basins. My preference would be that we have some type of report in a couple of, in the next biennium. Maybe agency can come back and tell us how this is working, that we reevaluate this time frame and see if this is enough time for the agency to actually do this. And it wasn't clear to me if, one of the things I would like to see possibly is a breakdown, and it would have been helpful for decision making here, is basin by basin, how many cancellations we're talking about. Is it in the hundreds? Is it, you know, just a few? And is it more of a burden on certain water masters? So that information would have been helpful in making our decision here. But I will support the amendment and ask the agency to come back with maybe a report to us next session. That would be helpful.
Thank you, Representative. And that's an excellent suggestion. I suppose that I can make the same comment in relationship to that that I've made, at other times, and talking about my teaching career and telling students that don't worry about it. The course is offered again next term. And I suppose I can pass the same thing on in relationship to this. Is the committee will meet again next term and or next session, and I'm sure if there's a problem that all of us on the committee will be interested and anxious to address that problem in such a way that it'll be meaningful, to the betterment of the use of water in the state. So I do appreciate your putting that on the record, however, that it would be your wish, and it would be the chair's wish, too, that we follow this issue carefully, and if there is, if we are, in fact, imposing a hardship that is causing other problems, that we make an effort to correct it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
In light of the fact, would you call the roll on the amendment?
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative Cruz.
Excused.
Representative Schaffler.
Aye.
Representative Tomei.
No.
Representative Dingfelder.
Aye.
Representative Krupp.
Aye.
Chair Jensen.
Aye. The conceptual amendment to Senate Bill 590A has been added. Would entertain a motion to...
So made, Mr. Chair.
Representative Krupp moves Senate Bill 590A as conceptually amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to be voting no again, just to express my concern about the limited number of days.
Thank you, Representative Tomey. Appreciate your... You call the roll again.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative Cruz.
Excuse.
Representative Shoffler.
Aye.
Representative Tomei.
No.
Representative Dinkfelder.
Aye.
Representative Krupp.
Aye.
Chair Jensen.
Aye. Senate Bill 598, as amended, as conceptually amended, moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And given the fact that we have received one no vote on this, we will be unable to put it on the conceptual calendar, and that will probably be good because this will give Representative Tomei an opportunity to speak specifically to this issue so that we will have on record in the House floor as well our concern about this so that if we need to look at it again next session, that record will be
there. Good. I'll do it.
With that, we need a carrier, and do I have a volunteer? Anybody want to carry this bill?
No.
Representative, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Representative Krupp will be the carrier. Thank you. Close the work session on Senate Bill 598. At this point, we are to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 576. And do we have a sign-up sheet on 576? Thank you. We have Rich Angstrom coming up. Go ahead with you.
Senate Bill 576 requires independent multidisciplinary science team to accept input and opinions from non-member scientists with certain expertise when discussing potential official action of the team.
Good morning,
Rick. So no amendments. There is a letter from the co-chair of the IMST in your files that was emailed to me this morning, and there's an information on the mission and charter of the IMST for your information related to this bill.
Need to pull a couple of things out here.
Okay.
Good morning. My name is Rich Angstrom. I'm the president of the Oregon Concrete and Aggregate Producers Association. OCAPA represents construction material companies through Oregon. OCAPA has 160 members statewide, including aggregate, asphalt, and concrete producers. OCAPA has been a supporter of the Oregon plan since its inception in 1997. OCAPA played a critical role in writing and financing the Oregon plan, and including a dues increase and a payment for the Oregon plan of $400,000. OCAPA firmly believes that habitat renewal and creation are the keys to reviving Oregon's fish population. OCAPA representatives have sat on and chaired the Healthy Stream Partnership and participated in the Willamette Restoration Initiative and Coastal Salmon Restoration and Production Task Force, providing valuable expertise and acting as an accessible resource to aid fish recovery. OCAPA remains committed to the Oregon Plan and its goals of fish recovery. Senate Bill 576 is intended to improve the IMST process. It's been an interesting process developing this bill because there's been a lot of discussion about the IMST process outside of the legislature, with many state agency folks that I've talked to that are concerned about the process that's going on at the IMST, as well as different industry groups that I've talked to. And OCAPA is not intending this to be a negative bill. Sometimes, as you move bills forward, you have to talk about the issues that have happened, so it puts it in context. But because we are an organization that not only participated but helped draft and write and support the Oregon Plan, we feel it necessary at times to come in and help improve what we see are deficiencies in the way the IMST process is working. And that is certainly what Senate Bill 576 does. Interesting, it's the IMST agrees with our assessment there needs to be some changes. If you look at one of the documents, it's just a single page that came out of the Oregon plan for salmon and watersheds. It's just a single page, and you should see basically a little microscope and at the bottom of and watersheds. It was just a single page I handed out. The IMST kind of summarized some of the problems that they're having, and what they said is through December 2000, the IMST had made 68 specific recommendations. About 30% of the recommendations have not received a response yet. About 30% of the responses to recommendations are too vague to determine impact on the Oregon plan, and 6% were judged by the IMST to put achievement of Oregon plan goals at risk. A better method is needed to ensure that the IMST recommendations are fairly, promptly, and openly considered by agencies. We concur with that particular analysis of the IMST and we believe, though, that the reason for this is that the way that the IMST conducts its business. IMST reports are often either ignored by agencies or not implemented because of the impractical or costly requirements that do not comport to current law, and I can give you examples of those if you wish. OCAPA believes the problem comes about because of the way IMST interprets its independence. The IMST is largely self-directed, reflecting the legislative intent of achieving impartial evaluations of the Oregon plan. However, independence and impartiality do not equate to a closed process. OCAPA found the IMST process not open or engaging, and consequently the opinions they issued on gravel removal that I've given you, just so you can look through them, failed to be practical, failed to use the best scientific evidence available, and failed to date to elicit a state agency response. OCAPA attributes this to the IMST's own charter, and I have a quote here, and one of the documents, Chair Jensen, that I've also given the committee is the charter for the IMST, and if you go, I think, towards the back of it, you'll see this section on confidentiality that talks about how the IMST conducts its business. And just to read that, if I might, it's a short paragraph. It shouldn't take too much time. To preserve the integrity and function of the team, team members will not publicly discuss ongoing deliberations or pending discussions that concern specific conclusions and or recommendations. While any member of the team is free to publicly discuss the subjects that may come before the team, they must explicitly indicate that they are not speaking as members of the team. Draft materials of the team are to remain confidential until the team approves them for release. The team finds that the public interest in encouraging frank communications between team members outweighs the public interest in disclosure, and that confidentiality of draft materials is generally accepted practice of independent science boards. However, the team may use such draft materials and other materials and information in consulting with colleagues, state agencies, or for technical review. But the team is responsible for ensuring the confidentiality of the materials, that the materials is protected. Specifically, OCAPA was not notified of IMST meetings. We were told we could not have draft material. We even had a body of scientists that were available to testify. Interesting about gravel removal in stream. It's very specific science that's involved. The people that are involved, the scientists, and there are only a few of them in the state, are called fluvial geomorphologists. The IMST admitted that they did not have any expertise in that area. ODF&W, I know, doesn't have anybody that has those credentials, nor does DSL. The industry does. Oregon State does also, has one professor that does those kinds of activities. But they were not consulted. And we felt that as they went through the process and they're looking at specific science related to an industry that they need to have within their process the ability to receive that kind of specific expertise as they deliberate and make recommendations. On the Senate side, we had one of the scientists for our industry come in and testify, and he was not able to be here today. And what his testimony was Essentially, the current chair of the IMST testified before, after I did, but before the scientists did. And he said that they already are doing what this bill does. And that was the gist of his testimony. Our scientist came up and said that the problem is if he, as a scientist, if he cannot have the draft documents and he can't engage, there's no way that he can read, he can look at the science, he can look at what other scientists they're quoting, that he could do a sufficient peer review to be able to come up and comment to see if they're on track. Because we were not able to get draft materials, we were really a little bit surprised when the only time we got to see it is when it was finally issued. And there was no time then to engage our scientists, or other scientists for that matter, that may have other views. I mean, this could go both ways. To be able to go before the IMST and say, hey, you need to consider this. We have these studies and we've done this kind of work. And we found that the IMST didn't consider either the current science where we were at. They were relying a lot of science that was from 95. And so essentially we had significant issues with how they did it. And we think this bill resolves that. Now, again, that's kind of past thinking, and it kind of puts it in context what we think is the problem of how the IMST does business. And I've kind of tried to step through the process and what I think are some of the flaws within the IMST. This bill will open up the process, and it only asks the IMST to consider other scientific information and engage the scientific community as they deliberate on important matters before them. This concludes my testimony, and I encourage your support of this bill. I'm open for questions, Chair Jensen.
Thank you, Rick. Are there questions for Mr. Angstrom?
I have one, Mr. Chair.
Please, Representative Dingfeld.
Thank you. Thanks, Rich, for your testimony. I have a question for you regarding, you were talking about the charter and operating procedures, which I had read many years ago and just recently glanced over. And I see they've been revised from when they originally were put in charter. So this is the revised version that we have, right, the 2002?
That's right.
And on the last page, page 5, under the second to last paragraph, it says review of teen products. And the sentence reads, the team will have major reports reviewed by technical experts to assess the scientific rigor and technical accuracy of the documents. And I'm just wondering if you don't feel that that language addresses your concern, the specific issue you raised about the lack of technical expertise on fluvial geomorphology, and if that would not be addressed in that paragraph, because to me that reads, you know, if you don't have the technical experts on your team, then you need to have other folks review it.
You're going to laugh at this, but I handed you guys all my copies and didn't keep one. if I might grab one, I could look at it.
I think you're getting some help right now.
I got two, so you can have mine. It's on page 5, second to last paragraph. That first sentence under review of team products.
The team will have major reports reviewed by technical experts to assess the scientific rigor and technical accuracy of the document. You know, I tend to agree with you that when they have the final, when they come up with the final report, that it is sent out, and it seems like the policy kind of picks that up. However, in our case, I saw no evidence of that. Certainly, they would have engaged us and our scientists, and specifically the specific scientists in this area. That was not done. But as far as that's essentially what we're trying to get at, that it needs to be peer reviewed, they need to consider other scientific information in the process. That didn't happen in our case.
Can I follow up?
Please, sir.
Well, two things. One is, I guess my point is, I'm not sure that the legislation gets to it, and maybe that's something we just need to have a discussion with the IMST. But I did finally get an email from Stan Gregory, who's the chair, and because I was interested in hearing his input. I don't know if this is part of the record, Mr.
Chair. But we have an email from the Chair, Stan Gregory, who I've worked with for many years, because I wanted to get his input on how he thinks the process is working. And one thing that he pointed out is that the IMST was modeled after the National Research Council. And, you know, I'm not saying that the bylaws are perfect, but the only concern I have is that making sure that we're consistent with other policy or other independent type of science boards in other states and on a national level. And so I'm not sure if this is something that needs to be legislated directly or something that we just need to work with the IMST and see if we can come up with a better process for input on their products.
I think Chair Jensen, Vice Chair Dingfelder, I think two things. One of them is that the IMST is a blend of scientific research and review, so that more pure science approach. But because the legislation, enabling legislation, allows them to make recommendations and certainly policy recommendations, that then they blend what the work that they do blends into the policy arena, so it isn't just pure scientific information. And once they blend into the realm that we are all at here, that they're required not only to follow public meeting laws. That they're all required to follow public meeting laws, but they have to open themselves up for the same kind of public scrutiny and review that you all have to do, or any other agency or any other body has to do. So when we put them together, we made them a blend of both. And so the policy and the charter that they are operating needs to reflect fairness, due process considerations that they may not have to consider when they're just considering a straight scientific review. And really, I have to say that maybe a big chunk of the problem is how they give recommendations and what those recommendations are. For instance, in our case, and you'll see this in the material I handed out to you, that on page 4, the IMST recommended that DSL regulate fill and removal activity for less than 50 cubic yards of material removed. That's a huge policy fight in this building. They recommended shifting on page 5. They recommended shifting the burden to a negative to no significant impact. I think burden shifting decisions need to be made by the legislature. On page 6, they talk about prohibiting gravel extraction. And on page 18, they talk about regulating migration areas in an essential indigenous habitat area that also is different than the current law. So those are great examples of where they really get outside of what the science is, and they move squarely into recommendations to you folks about some significant, serious policy considerations for you to deal with. The hard part for us now is that report sits out there, and NOAA Fisheries is using it, IMST is using it. DSL evidently will now have some kind of response and work through it. But in the meantime, as our folks are applying for applications, they're having to deal with this. It's costing them an awful lot of money. When they come out and say, you know, prohibit gravel extractions in the river, that's a pretty substantial policy issue. And not only that, it's going to cost people jobs and businesses. So I think the legislature, as they look at the statute, really needs to look at what they've created. And this is at least trying to open up the process so we can get the best scientific information in front of them. We didn't tackle the recommendation section, and maybe we should have, but we did what we felt was reasonable.
Rich, one last comment. It sounds to me that what you would like to see is the IMST, so it's not so much as far as the public meetings law and the open process, but what I think I'm hearing is you're saying you would prefer that the IMST does not make recommendation in their policymaking. I mean, and when I read this legislation, you know, it wasn't clear to me that that's where you were getting at, but
no. In fact, now Chair Dingfelder,
temporarily.
You asked a question about, more of a broad question, about how the IMST is more of a scientific organization, and I was trying to demonstrate how it's much more broad than that, because you've given them recommendation authority on policy matters. On our issue, and what we're trying to do only in this bill is not really tackle that, but open it up so when they are doing the scientific review, that it's very clear that they have to consider other scientists, and they need to open up the discussion at the outset so they engage the scientific community, including both the industry and environmental scientists, in so that they have the best information in front of them when they're rendering opinions. You have to look at, from our view, when an opinion is rendered and they admit that they don't have specific expertise in fluvial geomorphology, you have to question, well, what's the basis of it besides reading other people's literature?
Madam Chair, may I? What I hear him saying is, thank you. What I hear Mr. Angstrom saying is, he doesn't want a narrow body that hasn't been all inclusive making advice that becomes a rule that has the authority of statute, mm-hmm. that has an impact on you all. Without maybe another opinion being provided. That's what I hear you saying.
That'd be pretty much it. Chair Dingfelder, Representative Schaffler, that would be pretty close.
Any other questions? Thank you, Rich.
Thank you.
And I think Ray Wilkerson is on the list somewhere. I saw his name. Come on up, Ray. Anybody else here that wants to testify on Senate Bill 576? Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Ray Wilkerson of the Oregon Forest Industries Council. I think it's pretty well known by people who follow the Oregon plan since its inception that the forest industry has been a partner with the plan and a strong supporter since the very beginning. And we continue to believe that the IMST is an important part of the Oregon plan, and the IMST needs to be a respected and effective and a credible part of the Oregon plan. And in our view, it has not been and is not as respected and effective, as credible as it could be. And I think the reason is that, and the previous discussion reflects on that, is that the enabling legislation initially passed and currently on the books, continuing to be on the books, requires them to make recommendations. And I think that's something that's worthy of the committee's consideration, whether or not that is appropriate to continue that role. We haven't approached this with IMST itself, with the members. I would be very interested to know, and I apologize we didn't raise this issue in the Senate, and just belatedly bringing it to your attention, but I would be interested to know how they feel about that requirement. They're making recommendations not because they want to, it's because the law requires them to. And I think that has gotten them in some trouble from time to time. The one example, we didn't have the same experience that the gravel folks did on trying to access the process early when the IMST was doing a forestry report. But once the report was issued, it became somewhat controversial, quite controversial, because of the recommendations. The one example that that comes to mind is the current forest practices rules require buffers on fish-bearing streams. They don't require buffers on non-fish-bearing streams. IMSD recommended that be changed so that the buffers are the same on whether there's fish in a stream or not. Their reason for making that recommendation was never well accepted. They couldn't effectively explain why they thought that was a good recommendation. As a result, their report was criticized significantly by a whole bunch of people, and it undermined their credibility. I think it would have been better if they had just said, here's the effects, here's the consequences of requiring buffers on non-fish bearing streams, here's what will happen, here's how what it will do to water quality, here's what it will do to fish, and here's the effects and consequences if you don't. Provide that policy option, those options, the analysis, to the policy makers, which is the Board of Forestry. The Board of Forestry then is required to do an economic impact analysis under their law. They could find out what the cost of that choice is, and the IMST would provide what the benefit is, and then the policymaker could make a choice between the two options, rather than requiring the scientific team to make the recommendation at the outset. I unfortunately believe that IMST, again, does not have the credibility and the respect that it should have. There's been a vacancy on the IMST for 2 years now. I don't think there's, and it requires the Senate President, the House Speaker, and the Governor to agree on replacing IMST members. I don't think anybody's even looking at that or working on it. They're basically being ignored.
Yes, they are.
Okay, good.
This issue being brought to my attention here, I've started bugging at least the House side to move forward on this.
Well, good for you, Mr. Chairman. I think that's high time. There's going to be two more vacancies this summer, as I understand. But I think the problem has been that because their recommendations have been controversial, they have lost some respect and credibility that they would have had if they were just doing the analysis and providing the analysis to the policymakers. So I don't know what your intentions are with this bill, Mr. Chairman, and it may not be appropriate to suggest something, but if you wanted to consider this, what I'm suggesting on line 18 of the bill is the phrase about making recommendations for changes or adjustments to the Oregon plan. It would be a simple, mechanically, it'd be a simple thing to do in the bill just to remove that phrase. But again, I don't know what your intentions are. I frankly would not want to do something here that the IMST itself didn't agree was appropriate. So I'm not trying to push something, you know, be heavy-handed about this. It's just a perception that we've had over the years in watching this process that I think is worthy of your attention. Thank you.
Thank you, Ray. Are there questions from Mr. Brokers?
No, Mr. Chair, just a comment. Thank you, Ray. It's a good suggestion. Representative Dinkfelder and I have been talking about that, about whether to just make it permissive.
This committee is having a really strange effect on it.
But it's very rare, Mr. Chair. So I don't think she supported.
We don't talk about hatchery and wildfish. Yeah,
she did not support my bills yesterday, but that's a whole other issue.
See, we're bigger than that. Okay.
But I'm also curious, and maybe, Ray, you could comment on it. Section 1, sub 3, which basically requires agencies charged with the implementation of the Oregon plan to respond and to these suggestions. So that's something that would also have to be addressed, because I think that section in and of itself gives IMST legal authority beyond the scope of what was intended.
Representative Cruz, that could be. I think if you change the mission of the IMST to provide analysis of policy options, you could still require the agency to respond to what they think the appropriate choice is. There could be still be an interaction between the IMST and the agencies, even if the fundamental role of IMST was modified, I think. Just off the top of my head, I hadn't thought about it earlier.
Okay, well, I mean, this, you know, Mr. Chair, just a short follow-up. You know, I think, I'm not sure that we want to prohibit recommendations of IMST, but I think the appropriate place for those recommendations to come would be to the executive, to the governor, and to the legislature, because those are recommendations for policy, not recommendations for agency implementation. So,
Representative Cruz, if I could respond to that, I think the fundamental question is, there's a line, as Mr. Angstrom indicated, between science and policy. And once a scientist gets in the policy arena inadvertently, or because some law requires that, or for whatever reason, then there's trouble. You know, that causes conflict occurs, and then the credibility of the science, rightfully or wrongfully, is questioned, and the role is, they're not as effective as they could be. I think that's the point.
Mr. Chair, please.
Representative Shockler.
Yeah, I'm not against anybody offering a recommendation, but if we're going to create a buffer around a non-fish bearing stream, I'm amazed that the folks making the recommendation don't have to provide any kind of reasoning or analysis to back up that. Now, I may agree with that recommendation, but I'm not going to agree with it just because somebody says so. That amazes me. But thank you.
That was not a well-received recommendation, because...
Mr. Chair,
Representative Dinkfelder.
I just want to clarify, I mean, for Representative Shoffler, it's not that the research and science isn't done. It's just,
I believe,
who makes the final decision, I think, is the concern, whether it's through rulemaking with the agency
or with this legislative body. And that's something I think that we need a broader discussion on, and I think I see Rich's head nodding. I mean, the question is how much, and many of us here were involved in the development of the Oregon Plan, and you know, I can say that we don't have the expertise on this committee to make decisions on certain policy. However, we have to look at the recommendations come out of the IMST. The question is where that decision making lies, and I think that's really the crux of the issue here.
In this case, the decision maker under state law clearly is the State Board of Forestry. They're the ones that have the authority to regulate forest practices. So the suggestion here would be IMST should provide the Board of Forestry with an analysis of what their decision space is. Here's your five options. Here's the effect on the environment of each one. And then the policymaker, the Board of Forestry, makes the call.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Walker. I appreciate your taking your time. Are there other comments on?
Just to follow up on this sub three, Mr. Chair, because I agree with what Ray just said, but this would require the Board of Forestry in this case to defend themselves if they chose not to implement the recommendation, and I don't think that was the intent, nor should that be by design what happens.
Okay. At that point, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 576, and then we are going to open an informational hearing on withdrawing water from the Columbia River. And we have a panel, I think, of people who are interested in talking.
Mr. Chair, I'm in favor of it, by the way. So.
Okay. If we just had a bill, then we could vote it out.
No.
Yeah. That's fine.
I think it's, you know, what are the tribes that are sending something? We have a could be.
Good morning.
Morning.
Good morning.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Paul Clary again, Director of the Water Resources Department, and with me, Martha Pagel, former Director of the Water Resources Department. Before I move on to this, I just wanted to respond to Representative Flores' question on the notice of cancellation. We have to send that by registered or certified mail return receipt requested to the last known address of the holder of the water right, as well as notify the occupant of the land to which it's pertinent. So we do two notices like that. And we've got about 20 of them in the process. 25% of those associated with transfers, so give you an idea of what we've got. With that, we'll move on to the Columbia. We're here today to discuss water management issues on the Columbia, our approach, what we know about some of our sister states' approaches. We've got some written information as well as a map attached to the back of that shows the Columbia River Basin and some flow data, a flow data chart showing mean yearly flows, annual flows of the Columbia River at the Dalles. Columbia River is one of the unifying natural features of the Pacific Northwest. It drains a basin of about 259,000 square miles, includes territory in seven states in British Columbia, headwaters in Canada, flows for about 1,200 miles before reaching the Pacific Ocean, and we share with Washington about 300 miles of the main stem of the Columbia as our northern border. It's the fourth largest watershed in the United States, has an average discharge at its mouth of 198 million acre feet. About 10 times as much as the Colorado River flows, twice the volume of the Nile River. Give you an idea how much water that is. The Colorado River Compact, which allocates water for consumptive use among seven states, allocates approximately 15 million acre feet a year. It's home to a number of anadromous fish species, including five species of Pacific salmon, two trout species, 31 dams generating some 20,000 megawatts of electricity a year in good years. Like the other states in the region, we've tapped this resource. We've issued some 390 water rights on the Columbia and the Snake River system, totaling about 5,700 cubic feet per second. Give you an idea how much water that is. Some of the high flows of the Deschutes run in the 5,700, 5,500 CFS, so that would be basically diverting that entire lower Deschutes area. But again, in terms of the volume of the Columbia, a small percentage.
You have that purple flow on the Columbia?
Yes, sir. That last chart shows you the mean yearly flows. Now, this is in acre feet, and you see the tremendous variability. Average, this is at the Dalles, and this is where we've got the longest period of record. You'll notice they actually started gauging back in 1879. Average is about 138 million acre feet of water. From a peak of 224 million in 1894, a low period in 1977 of about 85 million acre feet. In terms of cubic feet per second, Mr. Chair, the Columbia River, and I don't have that chart in front of you here, but it varies. If we were to look at it in terms of, again, mean monthly flow, at the Dalles, it'll peak in the summertime in June on average at somewhere around 436,000 cubic feet per second. Low flow period looks like October at about 104. Interesting river, one that's not unlike a lot of the snow charge systems where we've got a lot of storage. What we've done is we've kind of shifted the hydrograph. What in a system that would have not had any storage in it would have been, you know, the maximum discharge in the spring period. We've kind of moved it into the summer period. But the flows in the Columbia are highest in the summer and lowest in the winter, unlike a lot of our rain-fed systems that they're the exact opposite. In terms of water rights, again, we've got on the Columbia and Snake River system a total of about 4,200 CFS for irrigation on about 220,000 acres, and then another 400 CFS for municipal and about the like amount for industrial and manufacturing. And we've got, excuse me, sir.
Is that the appropriated amount or the actual use as far as you know?
Sir, that's the appropriated amount. And of that, we've got about 325 cubic feet per second that's been permitted but not developed. And a good example of one of those would be one that we just successfully, I believe, completed an extension on, and that's for the city of Boardman. They came in for an extension on their water right for 23 CFS. They developed a pretty creative mitigation program involving water conservation, contributions to water conservation activities in the basin, and got the National Marine Fisheries Service to buy off on that, and so we're going ahead with processing that extension. If you look at it from primarily a main stem perspective, we divert about 0.3% of the average annual flow. Washington diverts about 2.7%. Idaho diverts about 4%. Obviously, there's a number of factors that affect that. If you look at the map, our ability to access the main stem is more limited than Washington's, and Idaho's on the Snake. There's also a little bit of a difference in the development history and the presence of the federal government. But nonetheless, that's a disparity that does concern water users in Northeast Oregon, and one that we're interested in working with the various stakeholders on addressing. We adopted some requirements.
Excuse me again. Can you explain the difference of appropriation out of the Columbia versus the Colorado?
Chair Jensen, in terms of the amount of water that's actually been appropriated out? Well, for consumptive use, the Colorado, by the time it reaches Mexico, is pretty dry. There's times when it actually doesn't reach the bay.
I just, but I'm talking about, is there not a an allocation formula for the Colorado version?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chair. There's an interstate compact on the Colorado. Occurred back in the 1920s, I believe, confirmed through various court cases, divided the river up, and now I'm going to show a bias from being an upstream state when I was in Wyoming, but somehow California had a little bit smarter folks or better hydrologists, but they got a guarantee that the upper basin states would pass at least 7.5 million acre feet down to the lower basin. And they did it on a period of record that turned out to be a pretty wet period of record. And so while we say it allocates 15 million, I think the longer term average flow is more around 13. So the upper basin states, while it's supposed to be 50-50, they ended up getting the short end of the stick. But it is a an allocation among those different states. The Secretary of Interior is the water master, if you will, for that allocation. And it's a matter of continuing dispute as well, even though it's had been negotiated some time ago. But we do not have an interstate compact along those lines on the Columbia River. We've got an interstate compact with California on the Klamath, but even that isn't the same type of compact. It doesn't allocate the river. It identifies from the date we entered into that compact, which was in the 50s, what our priorities will be for future rights. Like the rest of the states in the basin, in response to the fish listings in the early and mid 1990s, we adopted some new approaches for reviewing water right applications on the Columbia. They kind of mirrored at that time the emergency rules that Washington had that withdrew the main stem of the Columbia and Snake River from further appropriation, as well as a moratorium that existed in Idaho on the Clearwater and salmon. While we didn't have a moratorium, we did impose some pretty significant restrictions in those rules in terms of new water withdrawals between April 15th and September 30th. And that's the time period right now when there's a flow augmentation schedule on the Columbia and Snake. And the way that's been interpreted is that under the National Marine Fisheries Service biological opinions, they require a no-net loss or a bucket-for-bucket mitigation. We do have some exemptions to that restriction, domestic water projects that benefit fish, emergency use, and projects with measurable public benefits. And I think that we need to be looking more seriously about utilizing the tools that we've got there for those exemptions, as well as pursuing some of these more creative mitigation approaches that you might hear some from Martha about. We have issued some water rights recently. We've got four pending for about 700 cubic feet per second. Port of Morrow has got an application for somewhere six and a half, and the rest of that is pretty much the Hermiston Development Corporation. We've been meeting with them to talk about phasing those permits or getting them into an appropriate scale and then getting involved in our consultation. We've got some information on what's happened up in Washington. Like Oregon, had some restrictions. Here recently, they went through some court settlements, issued eight permits. One to the Tri-Cities area for 178 CFS over the next 50 years. The state is providing bucket-for-bucket mitigation for that for the first 6 years, and after that, it's the city's obligation to do that. And then there were seven irrigation permits for somewhere around 120 CFS total that were issued with a payment-to-provide requirement of $10 an acre-foot for water withdrawn. The state was going to collect that money, put it into account, and and during low flow periods, take it and use it to lease water to offset those withdrawals. That's an interesting concept, one that we think deserves further exploration in Oregon as well. With that, Mr. Chair, I think I've covered what I wanted to cover here. We're again interested in working with all the stakeholders up on that system, trying to find a way to streamline our process for reviewing and approving applications without reducing natural resource protections or diminishing state authorities. We think that there's a number of opportunities to do that. Some of it is just a matter of us not dropping people into a black hole once they've submitted their application and actually getting out and doing a lot of the leading the negotiations, if you will, on getting the applications processed.
Before we go to Martha, I remind you, colleagues, that this is an informational type of hearing, and you're certainly welcome at any time that they're speaking to interrupt to ask questions so that you know, doesn't get beyond your point of interest before you get your questions asked.
I have one question for Mr. Clary.
That's very good. Please.
Thanks.
Representing
Paul, under, I was just reading ahead a little bit where it lists current activities in Oregon
right.
and Washington, and under the current activities in Washington, you note that the moratorium, I think it's about halfway down, or second sentence, in Washington, that their moratorium on the issuance of new water rights from the Columbia and Snake has lapsed. Is that because, I mean, why is that? I'm just trying to understand. Is that a legislative decision? Is that an
impact? It was legislative. And they had a legislative moratorium probably with a sunset provision on it. But they then had to process it according to their existing rules. And what happened was a number of the applicants didn't want these applications processed by those rules that had been the bucket requirement and others. So they went into a court challenge because these were applications that had preceded the moratorium. The state decided to settle again on the big one. They did end up with bucket for bucket mitigation. On the others, they ended up with this payment to provide that in their opinion, in the long run, will provide them the amount of money they need to acquire water in low flow years. I guess if you go on the assumption that the low flow years might be every 2 out of 10, you collect $100 per acre foot of water withdrawn in 10 years, you can probably lease water for $50 an acre foot during the water short years.
Okay, thank you.
Martha.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. As Paul stated, my name is Martha Pagel. I'm an attorney in private practice. I was formerly director of Water Resources Department. I'm here today representing the Eastern Oregon Irrigation Association, and although the title implies irrigation interests, the association includes irrigators, public ports, municipalities, food processing industry, all types of economic interests in the Mid-Columbia region in Oregon. And we just wanted to kind of set the stage for you for the kinds of issues and challenges that are facing economic development in the region, knowing that you will later be considering specific legislation on this. As Paul indicated, the Columbia River conveys a vast amount of water, but it's not very easy to get to for development purposes for a lot of reasons. There are severe environmental constraints that have are resulting from or that resulted in listings of endangered species under federal law. We have listings under state law. We have complex management issues and jurisdictional issues because of the federal hydropower system, because of Indian treaty rights, because of interstate and international borders and jurisdiction interests in the river. So it's a very complicated river to manage. And what that means on a practical level is that it is darn hard anymore to get water rights, even though there's a whole lot of water there, that when the federal power system was constructed, it was intended that a lot of the water that is amassed behind the various dams would be made available for irrigation and other economic purposes in the basin. It is no longer practically available because of the difficulties in working through the permitting system because of these complexities. So what we are hoping is that this legislative assembly can grapple with that and try to provide some guidance and try to help us steer a course that acknowledges and addresses these issues. Nobody's saying we should ignore the environmental constraints or ignore the ESA requirements or the tribal treaty rights, but rather try to figure out a way that we can approach it in a more coordinated and effective fashion. And some of the tools that are available to deal with that. One would be a reservation of water. And this is authority that exists under the statutes, under Oregon statutes, to set aside water for future economic use. And it is specifically intended for that purpose. The statute authorizing reservations of water was enacted in the same legislative session at the same time as the law that created in-stream water rights, and it was intended to be kind of a counterbalance, that on the one hand we provide water for in-stream flow for public purposes, and on the other hand we look to the future and set it aside for future economic purposes. So a reservation of water is a tool that does exist under Oregon law. Even before that statute, as is indicated in the testimony that I handed out, even before that statute was enacted, the Water Resources Commission, or its predecessor, had a policy of trying to set aside water for future economic use. And so you see in a number of the basin plans, these are kind of water management plans that the state has adopted for the different river basins. Many of the basin plans, including the Umatilla Basin Plan and the John Day Basin Plan, purport to reserve water for future economic use. And the Umatilla Basin has a reservation for 30 million acre feet for future development. So it's a lot of water. That has never been realized because of legal complications. That reservation that exists in the rules and in the basin plan was done before the legislature created the authority that now exists, so it doesn't have any real legal significance. So one thing that the legislature can consider doing is clarifying or providing a reservation of water on the Columbia River for future economic use. It's important to understand, though, that a reservation is not a water right. What it does under current thinking and the way they're implemented now is that it identifies that right now a certain amount of water appears to be available to be allocated in water rights, and it creates a priority date as of the date that the reservation is established, for example, 2003. What it means is that people can come in the future and apply for a water right under the reservation, but they have to go through all of the steps and requirements in order to get a particular water right to use that reservation. So it is not a water right, and there's still all of the process, including the protections and the benefits of the existing system. That leads to another issue of concern in how water rights are managed on the Columbia River. Even if there were a reservation, if somebody comes in and applies for a water right, it is very, very difficult to work through the system. Paul Cleary described the procedural rules that are intended to address these complexities of the State Endangered Species Act and the Federal Endangered Species Act, and to try to figure out what are the appropriate requirements to make sure that new water uses are not going to further harm those species. But what we've seen is kind of this potential for a clash or an impasse between the state review process and the federal review process. So from a water user's perspective, it becomes very, very difficult to first have to go and negotiate with the federal government to try to figure out what you're going to have to do to comply under the Federal Endangered Species Act, and then come to the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife and go through the same process and maybe be given different requirements. So there's a fair amount of frustration that's developed over the years, and there's an interest in asking the legislature to help provide some guidance or to get the agencies to work together to try to develop some recommendations on how we could improve that process. bottom lines here are that water use from the Columbia River is a very serious management challenge. There's a serious need to be able to get access to Columbia River water. In most of these areas that we're talking about, groundwater access is not an alternative. Oftentimes you can use groundwater instead of going to surface water as we confront these Endangered Species Act issues, but we have severe impediments to groundwater use in this area as well. So there is a strong need to try to figure out a way to make the system work better to allow for economic development and provide appropriate protection for species.
Any questions for Martha?
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Martha, in your testimony, it talks about on your second page, in the third paragraph down, the Umatilla Basin Plan, which reserved by rule 30 million acre feet. Is that the only, and I read further that it was deemed by the AG's office to have no legal significance because it was enacted before the legislature provided the statutory authority. So is, and has there subsequently been any reservation of water?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, no.
There has not been.
No.
Okay. So at some point, and Mr. Chair, if I may.
Sure.
And so at some point, obviously the Umatilla plan was adopted. There were hearings. There were lots of I'm sure there's quite a record of testimony in regards to why 30 million acre feet was appropriate. Why have we not adopted any reservation of water since that time? Even after the statutory authority was granted, why has the legislature deemed that not appropriate?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, it's not been in front of the legislature to adopt a reservation. There is a bill that's come over from the Senate that deals with that, but it's an administrative process now responding to petitions, and it's limited to storage for multi-purpose projects. So the interest on the main stem of the Columbia isn't to create new storage projects. It's more to access the water that is currently backed up, slowed down behind behind the existing hydro system dams. So that under the current provisions, we may have some reservation applications that had occurred in some of the tributaries within the system. Powder River, I think, comes to mind. But the main stem, we haven't had anybody come forward and say, we want to construct a new dam on the main stem.
So if I'm understanding, Mr. Chair, Paul, you're saying that the reason we've not reserved any water for the
right.
uses of the Umatilla concept,
right.
plan concept, is that it's only for storage?
Under the current statutory scheme, yes, sir.
Okay, right. Martha?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, if I could add to that. When the statute was first enacted in 87, it was it didn't have any limitation for storage or any other specific type of water use. It just said reservation of water for future economic uses. As a result of some task force work and recommendations to the legislature, I think it was around 97, 95 or 97, the statute was changed for storage to say that reservations for future multi-purpose storage. The idea of coming to the legislature for a reservation is unique. I don't think it's been done before that it's been asked of the legislature to establish a reservation, and not wanting to get into specifics of any particular request that's going to be in front of you, one reason to consider it on the Columbia River is because of these very unique management issues and interstate issues that arise on the Columbia. And it's coming now because of what is perceived as an inequity with the state of Washington, which does have a reservation established under their system of administrative rules, and Oregon is perceived as not having anything that is equal to that because the reservation that was in Oregon's rules has been deemed to be not effective.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Shelford.
How large is Washington State's reservation?
Chair Jensen, Representative Shoffler, it's, I believe, 1.36 million acre feet or 1.32. I think it's 1.36. There's two different provisions. It was adopted about the same time as this reservation. I appreciate Martha being here because I always like to answer questions about D.C. before Clary. But as I understand it, in 83, there was a big concern about California iron diversions of water out of Oregon, and maybe even talk about some kind of way of connecting the Columbia to the south as opposed to the west. And so I think both Oregon and Washington, as preemptive strikes, entered into these reservations. 30 million acre feet is a huge amount of water. Our current use, I don't know what it would have been in 83, but right now we currently divert somewhere around 450,000 acre feet out of the main stem. So they were obviously, when they adopted that, had ideas either of large growth or trying to preempt something from the south.
Mr. Chair?
I have Representative Cruz.
It wasn't too many years ago that the state of Washington increased what they were taking out of the river. Did they do that under their reservation? I mean, was their reservation structured to where it didn't go away as ours did? So basically, what we need is another reservation to allow for allocation. Is that correct?
Chair Jensen, Representative Cruz, we can allocate today. There's no limitation other than the requirements to go through the process and the limitations that we've imposed on ourselves, as well as the requirements of the Federal Endangered Species Act. And I don't want to minimize those. But you're correct, Representative Cruz, that they are allocating against this earlier reservation. All they've issued since the adoption of their moratorium in the early 90s has been these 8 permits that came out of these lawsuits. And they're not going to issue any more water rights until they complete this National Academy of Science study, which I believe is scheduled for completion next spring, that is looking at the effect of water withdrawals on fish flows. So that's where they sit right now.
Okay. Follow up. And I'm trying to remember my numbers may be off, Mr. Chair, but I thought at one point I knew this, that the amount of water Washington was diverting from the Columbia for irrigation was something like 1.4% of the flow, and Oregon was diverting something like 0.4% or 0.04%,
right,
or something like that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, as I indicated, depending on the data source, and we'll use the data source that Martha's folks are using as well, Oregon diverts approximately 0.3% of the average annual flow. Washington, about 2.7. Understand.
I thought, okay.
When you look at the access to the river, they've got a lot of areas that
right.
that are much more direct flow access to the river, but it is a sizable variation. I think that's a concern that people have got.
And Idaho?
Idaho is about 4%, sir, and that's all out of the Snake.
Yeah.
There's no part of the Columbia that flows into Idaho.
Chair Representative Cruz, attached to the statement that I prepared are some background materials from Fred Ziari. Fred Ziari is the president of the Eastern Oregon Irrigation Association, and he's a consultant for agriculture and irrigation interests. And the concept that he lays out there is setting aside 1% of the flow of the Columbia River for future economic use in Oregon. And he calls it 1% per century. So they're thinking about the long haul here and trying to identify a path where that irrigators and other economic uses could have access to up to 1% of the flow.
Okay, Mr. Chair, as a matter of fact, I'm just a simple country boy and don't understand these complicated things. But I will forever fail to see how 1% of the flow of anything has an impact on anything.
It would have a dramatic impact on the agricultural products that could be raised in Umatilla County.
Mr. Chair, understanding that part of it, but 1% removed from a river, what impact that would have on the river or anything tied to the river is not that's counterintuitive to think that relationship would exist.
Mr. Chair, I have a question.
Yes.
For either Paul or Martha. How do you work with BPA on setting the flows that you need for hydro, and obviously they're also running water out during low flow for fish migration.
Mm-hmm.
Is that
right.
Is that factored into when you're working with NOAA fisheries? Who sets that limit?
Chair Jensen, Representative Dingfelder, the operation of the federal power system is constrained by their biological opinion, which if you read in the newspaper here recently now has been remanded for them to possibly do some additional work on. And what it determines is they've got these flow augmentation targets, and they've got some operational regimes on each one of those dams as well. And then they vary by water year. As you can see, probably what influences the flows in the river the most are both climate trends, and you can kind of see this chart that we had, the mean yearly flows. You can see the dry period that was occurring in the early 1900s, the wet period that we had in the 50s into the early 70s, and then back into a more variable period. But it's the climate signal as well as the day-to-day operations of those reservoirs is what I understand really affects the flows more than anything, and those day-to-day operations can depend somewhat on the power demands. I think from a fishery standpoint, Representative Cruz, what I understand is the concern is always the low flow. And we look at the Columbia River at the Dalles on an 80% exceedance basis. The low flow periods are September and October when they get down to less than 100,000 CFS. So if we're diverting 5 or 6,000 CFS, we're up in the 5 to 6% range. And then the cumulative effect of the rest of them. I thought I saw in one of these biological opinions where they said that in a low flow period, you could have upwards of 40% of it cumulatively being withdrawn by Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. Again, but I'm not an expert on the fishery things, and I'm sure you'll hear testimony as things go on the fishery side.
If I may add, with respect to the the allocation issue of how much water is available for BPA or the Federal Power System to generate power from, that's a kind of a complicated interaction where under those dams, the Federal Power System was created under federal law. They don't have state water rights, whereas other types of hydropower projects have a water right that gives them a certain amount of water that they're entitled to use, or they get, it's called run of the river, whatever comes through. On the federal system, they don't have a state water right, but by the same token, the state's authority to issue water rights is not impaired. So there's kind of a corresponding jurisdiction, and the federal government has never attempted to interfere with the state's ability to allocate water. At the same time, concerns may be legitimately raised that if you were to allocate all of the water, pull it out of the river, there wouldn't be anything left for the hydro project. Given the volumes that we're talking about on the Columbia River and are affected by the federal power system, we don't think that's really an issue.
Right.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Schaffer.
More of a comment than anything. Also in the paper, there was an article about wind-generated electricity. And we're talking about 100 years from now, which I love to do. Maybe someday we'll be able to generate electricity with the wind running down the gorge and take some of that burden off the dams so we can use that water for what we could out eastern Oregon help them folks out there.
We've tried that, Representative, until we came along with a ground squirrel.
Yes, Representative Jensen, you and I fought that battle.
There's always something in there.
And I think we've had conversations with the panel regarding that particular battle from time to time. So
Mr. Chair?
We won't go there today.
Thank you. Paul, let me establish again, based on your testimony written here, that the total annual discharge of the Columbia River is 198 million acre feet. Is that correct?
Chair Jensen, Representative Krupp, at the mouth, that's correct.
At the mouth, okay. And in your testimony, you talked about the Umatilla Basin rule provided for a 30 million acre feet reservation.
Yes.
Correct? Well, Mr. Chair, that's 15.1% of 198 million acre feet total discharge annually of the Columbia River. I guess what would concern me is this is 30 million acre feet of water reserved for future economic use over current uses and over what is reserved by Washington State. It would seem to me, I guess what I'd like to know, what's the total usage percentage-wise currently, and had the Umatilla plan been adopted, seems to me we'd be pulling an awful lot of water out of this river, and somehow the numbers are not adding up here in my mind.
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, I don't know where the 30 million acre feet number came from originally, but I don't think anyone today seriously is looking at that as the number for what might be a reservation if legislature goes in that direction. Also, the 30 million was intended for the Umatilla Basin, not the Columbia River main stem, and I think what you'll see coming before you is a request on the main stem, and it's more in the vein of that 1% amount, not the 15%.
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, might help. As you move up the river, of course, the mean flow decreases because you've got some huge tributaries that come in, such as the Willamette and the Deschutes and so forth. When you look at the Umatilla Basin, they probably were looking maybe at McNary Dam,
mm-hmm.
And I believe up there the average annual flow is somewhere around 126 million acre feet. So 30 million was a bit more of that area. But again, both Martha and I complete ignorance as to what was going through people's minds. But I have heard that some of it was to make sure that our neighbors to the south didn't get too greedy.
I think they look at the John Day Pool, don't they? More McNary Dam.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Martha, could you talk some about the chart on the back? And when it talks about in 2050 the water usage, is that with current permits or proposed permits?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, first I have to state that the chart was provided by Fred Ziari, and he is trying to show...
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, it looks to me like what he's saying is by 2050, mm-hmm. if you doubled the amount of use, you were withdrawn, or unless that's a million acre feet, a million acre feet, a little bit more than doubling the current mm-hmm. use, this would be the effect in those different time periods. So, if you look at the numbers, it's almost an exact doubling of them. And again, I think Fred does a good job here of showing, you know, the maximum, the average, and the minimum. And while we always like to think in terms of averages, we have to assess impacts in terms mm-hmm. of minimums. And so
right.
he does a good job of displaying that.
So this is... The bottom chart is intended for illustrative purposes. The upper chart shows the current uses.
Situation. Yeah.
In fact, on the bottom chart, as far as Oregon is concerned, it would probably be difficult to achieve that number of acres. I mean, the cost
right.
involved, even if you have free access to the water, the cost involved of moving that water to the higher ground
right.
And the number of miles that you'd have to move it would make it, at least in anything like today's market, totally impractical. I mean, there's just not that much. There's some land right. there, yes, but nothing right. approaching that number, I think, left for okay. development for irrigation purposes.
That's an excellent point. From a soil standpoint and a climate standpoint, we certainly have got a very good situation up there that if you put water on that soil in that climate, you can grow good crops, and you've got the transportation and the processing network. So probably of all of the state, Northeast Oregon has got the greatest potential for new irrigation use. But as you indicated, you've got some economic constraints. The further you move from the river and the higher up you have to lift the water, you're going to have some constraints.
I think the thing that the committee should probably know now is that this area that we're talking about is the largest food-producing county in the state. It's not the largest agricultural,
right.
but talking about food production in the state. So most of, not all, and we've gotten into a little bit of grass seed over there now, but We'll steal that from the Willamette Valley, I suppose. But food production-wise, it's the largest food-producing area in the state of Oregon.
Amazing.
We might also add that it's among the most highly efficient and effective food-producing areas in the state, or in the nation, really, because of very high-tech practices that are employed with temperature probes and satellites to make sure that they're using just the right amount of water and getting the maximum potential out of all the resources. So it's a really very effective, efficient systems that are in place there, and to some extent that's kind of penalized Oregon growers as we've entered this era of dealing with Endangered Species Act constraints. And often the solution, if you want to develop more water, is you have to mitigate and replace it. Well, in Oregon it's hard to come up with water that you can give up for mitigation purposes because it is so efficiently used. On the other side of the river in the state of Washington, you have a lot less efficient practices underway. You might have pasture irrigation going on, and it's really easier to buy out that kind of a system or to convert it to a more efficient water use where you save some water and have something available for mitigation. So we get somewhat penalized by already having moved over the past decade to more efficient water use.
It's more than somewhat penalized, I think, Martha, but she makes an excellent point for you to consider in there that, in fact, the efficiency of the irrigators in the Umatilla Basin is world-class efficiency. People from all over the world come to Umatilla County, Morrow County, to look at the technology that's being used. And consultant that you are seeing here, Mr. Ziari, is international in his scope of practice as far as where he goes to advise on irrigation projects and help develop irrigation projects.
Are there other questions? Well, Mr. Chair, may I? You know, if the bill we passed yesterday that allows us to delist animals in Oregon allows us to delist that old ground squirrel, maybe we can build some windmills.
It would be nice, but I think the state of Washington has already stolen that market from us.
Okay.
They were perfectly willing to not be overly concerned about this critter, apparently. And it's an interesting sort of thing since it's their ground squirrel, not by name, at any rate.
Mr. Chair, should be noted that the Washington ground squirrel is not listed under the federal ESA and is not listed under any state ESA of Washington State, because they don't view the animals being endangered in Washington State.
And I see the only representative that we have from the Water Resource Department is Mr. Clary and Abel back there. And of course, the former director when we went through some of that. So, okay.
Let's move on.
I wasn't here.
I was looking around, however, to see somebody from Fish and Wildlife, but I didn't see anyone from Fish and Wildlife in the room at this time. We would have been happy to have had them come up and explain this whole process to us.
I would point out, Mr. Chair, that we do have several gas cogeneration facilities on the Oregon side and several others that are in the permitting process or have gone through it and are just waiting to for the market to turn. They also use water. They can allow us to, because they've got that peaking capability, to use that if we need to modify the hydropower system. And I don't know that Washington's got those, do they? On the other side?
I think there's some on the other side. But the other one thing that I don't think they have on the Washington side that we have is I don't believe they're using any Wyoming coal in the Washington side. We have a
a coal-fired.
That's right.
On the Oregon side.
Plus, we've got the big highway.
One of those things that is good for the environment. We get rid of all that coal in Wyoming and convert their environment.
Extremely low sulfur coal.
Okay. Thank you very much, and
thank
we
you.
Are running out of time on this today. We are scheduled to hear Senate Bill 820, and we will be talking, I think, again with these folks on Thursday. As such, and unless there are some other things that come to our attention, I believe that's our only agenda item on Thursday. Okay? So we are adjourned.